from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor has not been shy about telling her own story. She wrote an autobiography from her seat on the court. Longtime Supreme Court correspondent Joan Biskupic takes it further into the life and chambers and high court role of the woman who's been called this country's most influential Latina ever. This hour on Point, Sonia Sotomayor and the Supreme Court. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you make of Justice Sotomayor, her opinions, her style, her sense of justice, her story? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here was Sotomayor's swearing in, August 8th, 2009, Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr., administering the judicial oath to Sonia Sotomayor. Private ceremony at the Supreme Court building.
I, Sonia Sotomayor, do solemnly swear
that I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
And that I will faithfully and impartially.
Discharge and perform.
Discharge and perform.
All the duties incumbent upon me.
And indeed she has. She's still growing, Sonia Sotomayor told PBS's NewsHour Gwen Ifill when she came out with her memoir, My Beloved World.
We're certainly not born a justice, which is something that Justice John Paul Stevens reminded me during my first year on the bench one day when I was actually disclosing to him how anxiety-ridden I was about being a justice. And he just touched upon a reality for me. He said, Sonia, none of us is born a justice. We grow into becoming one.
Have you grown into it?
Not yet, but I'm growing.
I'm growing. A wonderful candor right there. With us now from Washington is Joan Biskupic, legal affairs editor at Reuters. She's covered the Supreme Court for some 20 years for the Washington Post and more, has written biographies of Justices Sandra Day O'Connor and Antonin Scalia. She's out with her third biography of an American justice. It's called Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and the Politics of Justice. You'll find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Joan Biskupic, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you so much, Tom.
We heard you talking wonderfully with Nina Totenberg the other morning on Morning Edition, and we thought, we want to hear more of that. I'm really glad that you've done this. What do you mean by the politics of justice, Joan?
Well, I wanted to do more than any kind of straight biography. In fact, she had already done hers, and sure, I thought she'd be worthy more of a political history. How did she get on the court? What was her hand in it? And what was going on with Latinos in America nationwide that brought us all to that moment in 2009 that you so wonderfully played, where our first African-American president appoints the first Hispanic justice to the nation's highest court? So I tracked her life with the trajectory of Latinos in America. She was born in 1954, the year of Brown v. Board of Education, but also the year of Hernandez v. Texas, when the Warren Court for the first time said that Hispanics could be a protected class just like blacks. She's coming of age during the civil rights struggles in America. She enters Princeton in 1972, the year that the Secretary of Labor says that more minority representation should be on campuses. She was sort of at the scene at all these critical junctures. And then in the early 90s, just when President George H.W. Bush is looking around for more diverse candidates, and Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a Democrat from New York, is making recommendations to the Bush administration, she's there. She's there with her strong credentials and representing diversity that was just right for that moment. Then in 1998, when President Clinton elevated her to the Second Circuit in New York, she was sort of right there at the scene. So I thought it would be interesting to capture the moment of history that she steps onto. And then, Tom, she gave me an even better story because her first 5 years on the bench were so exciting.
We're going to look at those 5 years, the path in. As we do that, we want to think about her on the court now and what the court's looking at. I wish you'd just step back from Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor herself for a moment. Lay out the new sort of a groaning table of issues before the court in the coming year, so that as we think about Justice Sotomayor, we can think about what she's looking at right now. What's in front of the court this season, this time out, Joan?
Well, let's just think about what happened this week as the justices, through a series of orders, acted on gay marriage in America. What the justices did was say, temporarily, we're not going to hear any cases, but it effectively let 11 more states it ensured that 11 more states would allow same-sex marriage. But that issue could come back to them. So there's one, Tom. You're going to have the question of a national right to same-sex marriage. You also have affirmative action percolating back up to the Supreme Court. A lot of big issues. But right now, at least what they have on their agenda currently – are a couple of what we'd say, I never like to say they're B-grade cases, but they are ones that aren't super high profile. They heard one this week testing whether Arkansas can forbid a Muslim prisoner from growing a beard that he feels is important to his faith. It's a question of prison security versus religious rights. We also heard had the justices hear a case this week over labor rights. If you're required as a warehouse worker to go through a security screening at the end of your shift to make sure you haven't stolen anything, and that takes 20 minutes, should you be compensated for that? That's another issue that came up. Later this fall, they're going to have one that First Amendment test of what's on Facebook. If someone starts going into rants that could potentially be threats, what kind of speech protections might there be for those kinds of comments? So you'll see the justices dipping in on a lot of social issues, but there are even greater social issues to come down the road, including on voting rights, on potentially abortion rights, and certainly same-sex marriage will be back one way or another.
Describe then where Sonia Sotomayor sits in the constellation of nine justices at this point in terms of her kind of compass settings on issues like those you've just described.
Okay, she is one of the true lefties on the court. This is not a court made up of the kind of liberals that we had in Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan back in the, from the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. This is a much more moderate court overall. So our more liberal justices, who would be Senior Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, then Stephen Breyer, then Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. Of those four who were appointed by Democratic presidents and tend to be more on the left, I would say Justice Sotomayor might be the strongest on the left. It's sometimes a tie between her and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But her identifications definitely are on the left. Again, not as strong as a Thurgood Marshall, but they're there. And the way she's shown those so far has been fairly consistently voting for prisoners' rights, breaking away even from her liberal colleagues to protest when the justices might not take up a case involving criminal procedure for defendants behind bars. She set herself apart from the majority and, again, apart from her liberal colleagues on that. She has been one of the strongest voices in support of affirmative action. She has not broken out individually on issues of immigration, but that might come down the road. I just mentioned that as an issue that might be of particular interest to Hispanics. But I would say, Tom, just to orient her, she favors gay marriage from what we can tell. She hasn't voted directly on that kind of case, but she was with the majority last year when five justices struck down the Defense of Marriage Act provision that limited federal benefits only to opposite-sex couples.
Joan, your last biography out was on Antonin Scalia at the other end of the court in terms of his political leanings, his perspective, American original, the life and constitution of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. That came out in 2009. Talk to us about the difference between doing a biography on Antonin Scalia and doing one on Sonia Sotomayor in terms of access, process, the kind of communities that it took you into.
That's a great question, in part because I thought when I did Scalia, I had had it with my most polarizing justice. But it turns out that she remains a polarizing figure in America. As much as she's very beloved, she's what many commentators refer to as the people's justice, she still has a polarizing presence. And I think that's part of the sort of enduring legacy of race and ethnicity in America.
How did that show up? Where did you find that response?
It's so interesting. I found people saying, asking questions that, frankly, she sometimes hears and addresses, were you the best qualified? Well, look at her 17 years as a lower court judge. She was definitely qualified, but you still have a little bit suspicion out there. After her confirmation hearings, she told students that it was very painful to her to hear people second-guess her qualifications, and she chalked that up to her being Hispanic. She gets right out there and confronts that. That's why I say she can still be polarizing. But in terms of access, Justice Scalia actually gave me lots and lots of access that many people wouldn't suspect because he might project a different kind of image out there in public. But I had 12 on-the-record interviews with him. With Justice Sotomayor, she let me come talk to her. She spoke for the record, but she was much, much more careful. She wanted to clarify things rather than to act like she was giving tremendous access. And in part, I think it was because she was writing her own memoir at the time. She wanted to tell her story. And when I would go see her, I would say, what I'm doing is not the book you would write. You're doing the book you would write. But she was open, and she and her people let me follow her around to various events. I followed her in San Juan. So that was exciting, and that was fun. It was I'm not an Italian American and I'm not a Puerto Rican, but I, for both of those tales, I wanted to tell it more through a political lens, and that's what I was doing here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the still emerging profile of the first Latina Supreme Court Justice, Sonia Sotomayor, and her role in the court's agenda and direction right now, her likely role in its future. With Joan Biskupic, she's written biographies of Sandra Day O'Connor, of Antonin Scalia. Her latest is Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and the Politics of Justice. Joan Biskupic joins us from Washington. She's covered the court for many years, spoke there of Sonia Sotomayor's hurt, and she's candid about it, at some of the kind of questioning and assumptions that hit her when she was being reviewed by the Senate for her place on the court. Here was Senator Lindsey Graham in that 2009 confirmation hearing.
Unless you have a complete meltdown, you're going to get confirmed. And I don't think you will, but, you know, the drama's being created here is interesting. And my Republican colleagues who vote against you, I assure you, could vote for a Hispanic nominee. They just feel unnerved by your speeches and by some of the things that you've said and some of your cases.
Joan Biskupic there, Senator Lindsey Graham, unnerved by your speeches, things you've said. Is that panning out? Were people who, if they were indeed unnerved, is that carrying forward into her time on the bench? And I guess the opposite as well. Who sees her as a particular champion on the bench?
Well, he's referring to primarily, I remember, her wise Latina speech. You remember that, Tom,
sure.
Where
yep.
She had said that given the experience of a wise Latina, she might make a better decision than her white male counterpart. She didn't mean to be actually saying that somebody would decide a case completely differently on the law. She was trying to sort of talk about the experiences that somebody could bring to a matter. But, you know, she's continued to talk about ethnicity and race in her speeches. And we also saw that theme emerge just last year in a Michigan affirmative action case when she dissented from a majority ruling that allowed the state of Michigan to ban any kind of racial consideration in higher education applications. And she said something in her opinion that I think, Tom, we could have heard her say in one of her speeches. She said, race matters because of the slights, the snickers, the silent judgments that reinforce that most crippling of thoughts. I do not belong here. I think she knows of what she speaks there. I think she feels like that's the kind of shadow that she still feels some of, despite the fact that she had been a federal court judge for some 17 years before she joined the Supreme Court. She's now had 5 years on the Supreme Court. And I think her colleagues regard her as, completely a full player. I know they do. It's just that there'll be times when she certainly breaks from the pack on some issues that I've referred to earlier, but also in terms of this kind of celebrity status. Tom, I think she has to be the first person who's first justice who ever dropped the ball on New Year's Eve in Times Square.
Yes. Yeah, you've got that. I described her in the introduction as sharp, and by which I was thinking exactly of her dissent, her writing in this Michigan case, which has often been described as blistering. I mean, it really went at the issue of race, saying that it's a facile notion that race doesn't matter in this country. Antonin Scalia can be very sharp-tongued as well. How has she shown her spurs, her capacity to sort of turn and get the attention of the court when something really matters to her, Joan?
Well, that, you know, you just used that wonderful phrase, when something really matters, because until that moment, she hadn't shown much really fiery rhetoric. Her opinions, for the most part, have been pretty workmanlike, pretty straightforward, not that kind of passion. But she really emerged with that dissent in the Michigan case of just last year. And I think you know, Tom, that what I discovered in the reporting was that a year earlier, she had written a version of that in the University of Texas affirmative action case and actually gotten the justices to retreat a bit so that she never had to make that dissent public. She ended up signing on with the majority. So she's obviously picking her shots. She's not coming at things every single case, every single term, with her point of view from her personal experience. And in fact, what she says to me is she's actually not trying to be a flamethrower. She's trying to approach things in a lawyerly, judicial way. We have to remember that unlike Thurgood Marshall, or even unlike Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was on the cutting edge of women's rights issues as an advocate, Sonia Sotomayor is essentially a second-generation advocate, if you even want to use that word.
Meaning?
She was born, you know, as half a generation after Thurgood Marshall. Mm-hmm. She did not found the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund. She was a board member, as opposed to Thurgood Marshall, who actually founded the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. She did not stand up in front of judges at the trial level, appeals level, any level, advocating on behalf of Hispanic rights. That was not what she did. She was, first of all, she was a prosecutor, quite on the other side for some things, and then she became a judge. So she was a board member of the Puerto Rican Legal Defense Fund, as it was called back in her day, but she was not spearheading the issue. So I think that gives her a sort of different sensibility and different role. So she wasn't naturally inclined to be, as she would say, a flamethrower behind the scenes with her colleagues, even though I know she's quite confrontational.
Talk about the Texas case, because that is where she really worked hard, behind the scenes. When you winkled that out of your sources, the story of how she had pushed on that case, it was a little upsetting to Justice Sotomayor. She wanted a full explanation that she had not come to you. She wanted to be sure that was somewhere between the covers of your book.
Right, and I felt I didn't mind doing that for her, because what I said to readers, and I as you know, I always have extensive endnotes in this. I said that, you know, individual justices from both sides of the ideological divide revealed elements of this discussion in the University of Texas case and the draft opinions that were circulated that at one point were quite sensational.
What do you mean by sensational, Jen?
Well, hers really was a scorching opinion that had a lot of the strands that we saw a year later when she talks about race matters. You know,
But this wasn't a public opinion. This was circulated among the justices. This is the inside conversation.
In fact, Tom, just so your listeners know, and I know you know, this is quite a mysterious institution we're talking about here. Once they have all oral arguments and take a preliminary vote on a case, a conversation continues, but it continues in writing. They send around draft opinions, multiple draft opinions. And some of us are so lucky when we finally get to see these opinions when retired and deceased justices make their papers available. But until that moment, we really have to count on what's in the public record, but then also what someone like me is able to get from individual justices. And I make clear in this discussion in my book that not all the justices would speak about the case, and Sotomayor herself declined to disclose private negotiations. And I acknowledge to readers that even though I got this nice little scoop, internal court documents are kept secret, so a full understanding of the give and take remains elusive. You know, so I want to, you know, make sure people know I found out something really important, but there are limits to what you can find out until you actually have your hands on the hot documents.
But you could see from what you learned that her passion, explicit with the other justices, really mattered in how they finally came down here.
It did. And when I said, you know, please, you know, give me some lines from that dissent in the University of Texas affirmative action case, anything that I can understand, you know, anything that will help me understand how passionate she was, because one of the justices said to me it was a dissent that only she could write. And when I asked that, a couple of the justices said, just wait till you see what emerges in this Michigan case. And we did see that. I think we saw, you know, it was a different issue, different. One involved just pure higher education in Texas. The other was a statewide voter-approved ban. It was a different issue, different question, not directly addressing affirmative action in higher education. Rather, it was addressing the power of people to go to the polls and enact this kind of initiative. Mm-hmm. But we certainly saw the threads of her personal understanding of what it means to face discrimination and to face the kinds of slights that she mentions. Now, for your listeners who remember that case last year, Justice Scalia came back quite sharply against her, and Chief Justice Roberts wrote a separate concurrence himself saying, I don't think it does either side any good to be airing things this way or second-guessing each other about do you get it or do you not get it.
She was very much in the do you get it or not get it mode, though. She wrote in her dissent in that Michigan affirmative action case, race matters for reasons that cannot be wished away, Justice Sotomayor wrote. Race matters to a young man's view of society when he spends his teenage years watching others tense up as he passes, no matter the neighborhood where he grew up. Race matters to a young woman's sense of self when she states her hometown and then is pressed, no, where are you really from, regardless of how many generations her family has been in the country. How in line with or outside the line of tradition is that kind of language in a dissent, Joan?
It is personal, although she wasn't talking personally about herself. I mean, she's putting it in the third person, essentially. Mm-hmm. But we don't get that kind of language usually in opinions. We tend to see, you know, first of all, they're filled with jargon. Sure. It's sometimes very hard to quote from the opinions just because they're difficult on the ear. But when it comes to complaints, when it comes to sort of protesting back and forth between majority and dissenting opinions, it will usually be on the law. It won't be as colorful. It won't be as intimate. So yes, it's unusual, and it was obviously speaking from her experiences, because as I said, if you followed her around through all her speeches, which I have, they are of that tone completely.
Joan Biskupic is with us. Her new book is Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and the Politics of Justice. Callers for you, Joan. Orlando is calling from Miami, Florida. Hi, Orlando. You're on the air with Joan Biskupic.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Joan.
Hi.
I just had a thought when you were asking all your questions, what do the public think? And I think that it's good for the country in the sense that we're moving ahead in a very progressive manner. And it's refreshing to see at the federal level. I've been learning a lot about affirmative action plans in the workplace, and it's very interesting, and I'm really glad that the highest court to set an example and say, you know, we're being more integrative now. And you can see more of what represents the United States at the federal level in terms of the courts.
Orlando, I'm very glad for your call from Miami on just that point. Thanks very much for calling. I mean, Joan, she's relatively young. Coming into the court, it may have raised the kind of questions that Lindsey Graham was pointing to there, but over the course of her tenure, the Latino population of this country, and our caller Orlando in Miami points to this, but we're headed toward maybe a third of the country by mid-century. The idea of this demographic, if we have to put it that way, not being represented on the court could come to look really anachronistic soon.
You know, in 2009, when President Obama appointed her, Hispanics represented 16% of the U.S. population. And during the 2000s, leading up to that moment, Hispanic population had grown four times faster than the overall U.S. population. And really, since President George H.W. Bush in the 90s, presidents had talked about putting the first Hispanic on. But, you know, it is a political process. Right when we started, Tom, you referred to part of the subtitle of this book, The Politics of Justice. This appointments to the federal bench, particularly to the U.S. Supreme Court, involve a lot of politics. And for years, decades even, Hispanic groups had not coalesced around a single possible appointee, and presidents hadn't had a strong interest to doing that. I mean, there were other political considerations mm-hmm. along the way. But when we got to 2009 with those kinds of population figures, which are still growing, as you just said, and the moment we were in, the time was right.
Ryan in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Ryan, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. You asked a question earlier about if we thought Sotomayor's race mattered or not to us. And I absolutely do not think race matters. Positions like that, and even in the private sector, should be filled by qualification. You know, who's best for the job, who's qualified. And I think affirmative action and quotas that colleges and jobs use, that they have to hire X amount of this kind of people, are very counterproductive. And they almost seem racist in themselves.
So I hear exactly where you're coming from, Ryan. I know that line of critique, but then how do you hear Justice Sotomayor when she says, I mean, she's almost speaking right back to you in some of her dissents and opinions, saying race does matter. And we've been quoting here sort of her rationale for why that's true.
It's a straw man issue. I look at it, the individual character. Racism is an ugly form of collectivism. And you should really judge a person by their individual character, not the color of their skin, where they came from.
Ryan, we've got it. Joan, channel a little bit of Justice Sotomayor back to our caller, Ryan, here. Her own opinions would seem almost to respond to him. What might she say here?
Well, what I'd say is actually the Chief Justice of the United States and several of her more conservative colleagues feel that it is time not to take race into mm-hmm. consideration. Chief Justice Roberts, in voting rights cases and in affirmative action cases, has talked about how exactly what the caller is addressing, kind of the flip side of it, the unfairness. This he, in one opinion, referred to what he called this sordid business divvying us up by race. And he right now has had the votes to roll back some race-based measures. What Justice Sotomayor says in response is, it's not time yet. It's really not time. You know, it would be nice if it was. It would be nice if, as Justice O'Connor wrote in 2003, the clock can be ticking and maybe these measures won't be needed in the near future, although Justice O'Connor herself thought it would be 25 years down the road since after 2003, and we're hardly that far yet. What Justice Sotomayor says is, you know, look around. Racism is still out there. Affirmative action is still needed for people. And I do want to draw a distinction between what she says about affirmative action still being necessary to others and what she says about her own experience. Now, she has said she was the perfect affirmative action baby, but she will fight anyone who suggests that she got appointed to various positions simply because of her ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And she will point to her experience at Princeton and at Yale when she earned many honors and said they weren't given to her like little pats on the head.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor with Joan Biskupic. She's written biographies of Sandra Day O'Connor and Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, Justice Sotomayor. Her new book is Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and the Politics of Justice. She joins us from Washington. Sonia Sotomayor can be tough in her opinions. She can also have fun. Here she was. This was 2012. She stopped by Sesame Street to talk about her job with Maria and Baby Bear. Somehow hard to imagine some of the other Supreme Court justices settling in to chat with a puppet on a kid's show.
Hey, I heard that there was a Supreme Court justice on Sesame Street.
There is, Baby Bear. There is.
Hi, Baby Bear. I am Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor, but you can call me Justice.
Oh, well, you can call me Baby.
Okay, Baby.
Okay, Justice. Now, to be clear, what does a justice do again?
A Supreme Court justice is a judge who solves arguments by giving his or her opinion.
There's the Justice Sotomayor on Sesame Street. Joan, she's willing to roll and kind of mix it up, even within the confines of the court. You shared some of this wonderful story with Nina Totenberg about a time when justices get together for skits, and she was ready to dance.
Oh, yeah. That was at the end of her first term when she was, she'd barely been at the joint, and she's at the party celebrating the end of the Supreme Court's annual term, and it's an incredibly exclusive affair. Even part-timers aren't invited to it, just the full-time staff. And the law clerks put on musical parodies. And, you know, tradition is that the clerks do these little skits and the justices watch. Well, at the end of them, in June 2010, Justice Sotomayor springs from her chair and says, well, that's all fine and good, but there's something – they were lacking a certain something. She has her clerks cue some salsa music, and she starts dancing. And first she pulls in other law clerks as her partners, and then she goes toward the Chief Justice, John Roberts. And she gets him to get up.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. She gets him to get up and dance. He was a good sport about it. He was a little taken aback, but he was a good sport about it. And then she goes by one to other justices. And then she shouts toward the back of the room where Justice Scalia is. She says, where's Nino? Calling him by his nickname. Gets him to dance. And then even gets Justice Ginsburg, whose husband had just passed away, and she had just endured many, many difficult weeks. She gets her to dance by saying, Marty, your husband, would have wanted you to get up. And Justice Ginsburg puts her hands on Justice Sotomayor's cheeks and says, thank you.
Well, that's just a great scene. I love that you've brought that to us. And something quite different for this court. Joan, I want to keep it real in another way here right now, if I may, for just a moment. I just invited into the studio with us here in Boston. You're there in Washington. But Amanda Gomez works with us. She was raised in East L.A. She's 21 years old, senior at Emerson College, and a wonderful part of our team here at On Point. Amanda, say hi to Joan.
Hi, Joan.
Hi, Amanda.
And I had asked Amanda just before we went on the air about her memory of when it came down that Sonia Sotomayor, first Latina, would be on the Supreme Court. And I just enjoyed hearing her memories of that time, her family, her school. She would have been in high school then. Is that right, Amanda? And what was the response in your community, your home?
Right. So, and Joan alluded to it a bit in that I remember my mother had said that it was nice to see someone who, you know, represented her, and that it was good to see that a Latina was on, you know, our highest court, and because Latinos are a growing community. So that was our first impression of the entire situation. But, I mean, with that, we didn't automatically, and I remember my high school teacher had asked us our opinion. He was, oh, so what do you think is going to happen now that a Latina is on in the highest court? And especially we were curious about affirmative action. And I remember thinking, I mean, this is a monumentous moment. But again, I mean, I have no idea because
she was Latina, how
exactly.
She would vote.
We can never assume
anything. I mean, we've seen Clarence Thomas as African-American with his own very particular view of the law.
So, I mean, you have really no, you're not sure of anything. But it was nice seeing that there another face, another woman, another a Puerto Rican in this case, in the highest court. So.
Your family, Mexican-American.
Yes, Mexican-American. But, I mean, again, the Latino community is now represented, and we were really happy about that.
And what do you say to people? And we hear them on the show, Ryan calling in saying, look, race doesn't matter. Race shouldn't matter.
See, that's the thing. I don't buy the color blindness argument. I think that race is a part of who you are. I mean, it's not all you are, but it's definitely a part of your character. I mean, your upbringing, because, I mean, it's how you're raised. I'm not necessarily raised the same as someone from an Irish community. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing. This is, you know, we have differences, and we have similarities. And
you're 21. What would you think if you got to be 31 or 41 without seeing a Latino, Latina on the high court?
Well, I would be bothered because it's a very large community and we wouldn't be represented in that's essentially just what it, and that's why now we need to get a Asian American. You know, let's get the
everybody up there. Amanda Gomez, wonderful to have you. Thanks.
Thank you.
From our On Point team here. Joan, you can hear Amanda's response right there to Sonia Sotomayor. Did you hear that echoed in others that you spoke with from the Latino community?
Yeah, in fact, she reminds me of that moment about the wise Latina remark. You know, Lindsey Graham earlier in the segment, Tom, referred to some of the speeches that some Republicans didn't like, and one of them was the wise Latina. Well, folks out in California, maybe even near Amanda's hometown, started buying wise Latina T-shirts. Essentially, people wanted to be seen as a wise Latina. So it cuts in both directions. And I think that's part of what's going on here is that it can be seen as a very wonderful expression of the diversity of America, but she can also set off people in the opposite direction. And all the sort of tension and energy from 2009 hasn't really faded. It's still strong, as you saw from the passion that Amanda shows now, and the caller Ryan in the opposite direction.
Lisa is calling from Boston. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Nice to be on.
Great to have you. What do you think?
Okay, so when I read her autobiography, at the very same time, there was a 3- or 4-part series in the New York Times about a young girl who was living in the largest shelter in New York. And it was about the disparity of where she lived and the houses that she would pass by. And what really struck me, though, was the support that the justice had growing up, her expectations. I mean, things weren't always good. But she did have that goal that she was going to do well in school, and that was incredibly important. And you looked at this other girl where she didn't get that same support. And just reading the two of them at the same time, it was amazing to me of the support. I mean, she always had it, her circle of friends in Princeton, everywhere. She gathered people who were behind her. I was always just impressed by that.
We'll take it to Joan, and it was not always easy. As it sounds like you know from reading her autobiography, My Beloved World, she talked, Justice Sotomayor, about that with NPR's Nina Totenberg. This was in 2013, in particular about her father, who died of alcoholism when Sonia Sotomayor was 9, and talked about how her mother raised her after that loss. Here's a bit of that.
It has taken us, my mother and I, a lifetime to deal with the effects of my father's alcoholism on both of us. It's often a mutual ignorance that causes, I think, people to be angry at each other and not forgive. And one of the greatest lessons of my life with my mother is both her capacity to forgive and the gift of her teaching me how to as well.
Justice Sotomayor, talking there with NPR's Nina Totenberg. Joan, how do you interpret her drive and her very deliberate steps toward her ultimate destination, I guess, on the Supreme Court in the context of that upbringing?
Yeah, she did not lack for ambition or drive at all. And going back to what the caller said about the structure that she had under her, her mother was very driven. Her mother came from nothing herself in Puerto Rico and came here, became a nurse, worked very hard, always a couple jobs to support her 2 children. And then beyond her family structure, which also included a grandmother with whom Sonia Sotomayor was very close, were the faculty, the teachers, people she gathered along the way. She tells a wonderful story about realizing quite young that you can ask for help and get it. And she has built these networks all along of people who are fabulous boosters of her and watching out for her at every turn. And so I think the caller's point is well taken on that. She also does admit that, you know, once she realized that her life was going to be more focused on her career than some, you know, more of a personal home life of raising a family, she did not want to stint on ambition for that. And so she does sometimes act like, oh, well, this just happened to me. But nothing just happened to Sonia Sotomayor. She was an agent for herself and quite effective.
John in Austin, Texas. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Joan.
Hi.
I wanted to explore a little bit further this University of Texas decision because it seems to me the dynamic of what happened there is kind of revelatory about the court and how its process goes. It's my understanding, and Joan, you correct me if I got this wrong, but that the court had already decided on a 5-3 vote to uphold the complainant's Fisher in that case against the University of Texas, and that so and with Kagan recusing herself, and that Sotomayor was assigned the duty of writing the dissenting opinion. She was on the, you know, the three side of the 5-3. And when she finished it, it was so passionate and so scorching, to use, I think, a term in your book, that Breyer and Kennedy decided that this kind of thing just couldn't be published in the way it was written. It was so intense and emotional that they decided to finesse the whole thing by sending it back. And the case is still out there in the courts, the lower courts, even now, because they basically just didn't want to, you know, to bring the emotions out into public. Am I getting this wrong, or did Justice Sotomayor actually almost, hold up the rest of the court and kind of emotionally blackmail them into backing off?
John, we'll get Joan's view. Joan Biskupic, a very attentive question there from Austin, Texas.
It was an excellent question, and I'm happy to address it, because there certainly were those kinds of strains, but it was more than that. Because, first of all, just so the listeners know, there is this conversation that goes on in draft. So nothing's really set in stone. And in this case, it occurred during an unusually long 9-month set of negotiations. And my sense of what happened behind the scenes is that a justice like Anthony Kennedy wasn't as locked in as saying, I'm not going to budge off of this. You know, I'm hard and fast. And even the Chief Justice, I don't believe, was as hard and fast either. Now, Justices Thomas and Scalia felt pretty strong about where they were at. And Justice Thomas was not going to back off of his view that this program, the University of Texas policy, was outright wrong and we shouldn't have any kind of things like this. It was more just to flesh out what the caller's talking about. I wouldn't characterize it as emotional blackmail, even though it was a very emotionally tinged statement. It was more addressing the timing. Does this need to be so flatly rejected? Why not send it back and ask the Fifth Circuit to look at it again? I believe that some of the key justices who might be against the kind of policy that Texas had felt like there will be good enough time to reject those kinds of policies nationwide. It does not have to happen in this particular case. So I just think it's better to think of it a little bit more broadly, or at least I do, given what I've been told by the various justices.
So you're not running with the view that it was, in a sense, sent back because it was too passionate, or?
No, I'm saying it was a passionate. Well, what happens is that she gets the justices who feel very strongly that that the court should issue a stronger signal against affirmative action, or even any real strong signal against affirmative action, to back down. But it's not just her. It's sort of an ongoing conversation with compromises all around. Now, she didn't get all of what she wanted. In fact, Justice Ginsburg in that case still dissented, saying there is really no reason to send it back at all to the Fifth Circuit and have the Fifth Circuit reexamine what it did. And the only thing I want to put a caution on is to say it was only because of the emotional statement. It was only the phrase that the caller used, emotional blackmail. I think it was more than that, because I think that Justice Kennedy, for example, who is against these kind of policies, as we saw in his University of Michigan dissent in 2003, knew that he couldn't just all of a sudden have his dissent become the majority opinion without further explanation, but was more in the market to seek a compromise here. And the other thing that I'm sure – the caller is incredibly attentive to this issue, so I'm sure he recalls that the challengers to the University of Texas in this case – did not ask the court to outright reverse its ruling in the 2003 Grutter University of Michigan decision. So there was some wiggle room. There was already some wiggle room in this. So as the conversation begins between the dissent and majority, it was a little bit easier to have compromise this time around, and not just because of the emotions. Although, when I found out what was in that dissent, I think the strong passion certainly affected people.
John in Austin, thanks for your very attuned question there. Joan, we've just got a minute here. Where do you see, with all you've learned and are sharing here about Sonia Sotomayor, how do you see her developing in this role? Where do you imagine her going over time on the High Court and her role there?
I think we'll see her continue to stand out. I think that she has shown a greater willingness to separate herself from her liberal colleagues than President Obama's other appointee, Elena Kagan, who has been pretty closely aligned with the senior liberal Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I believe we'll continue to see a very public presence beyond the marble walls that we don't see from the other justices.
That's been fun. We'll see where it goes in terms of decisions and impact on the court. The whole story is really great read, Joan, and we appreciate you being with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Joan Biskupic, author of Breaking In, The Rise of Sonia Sotomayor and the Politics of Justice. Tomorrow in this hour, we'll talk with the Spanish Harlem Orchestra, salsa, jazz, and a lot of great energy. We'll hear their sound. Please join us. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Madeline Moore and Amanda Gomez. Wonderful to have Amanda with us today. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.